This is Interpreting Wine podcast founder and host Lawrence Francis welcoming you to my first ever deep dive into a single producer with Waterford Distillery of Ireland. This is the type of series I've been wanting to make ever since starting the podcast back in 2017, giving as it does unrivaled access for you, the listener, to all levels of the company, from strategy and history right the way through every single production detail. I think you'll agree Waterford are doing something very special, and I'd highly recommend subscribing to the podcast so that you're alerted whenever new episodes go live. Today's episode of the Waterford Distillery Special features CEO Mark Rainier. Given unparalleled access, we take a low and slow approach to his wine origin story and how this translates into the whiskey world, which he then weaves into his story at Brookladdie, talking origins, the drama of acquisition, production, marketing, marrying wine and whiskey, and the evolution of the distillery. Enjoy.
I grew up in a wine family. My father took over his father's business that started around about 1912 when he came as an immigrant from south of France, from Marseille, Nice, and to Pimlico. And he brought with him wine to keep him going. And the émigré community that sort of built up in Soho of French and European people, you know, he would supply wine to them. And that's where J.B. Rainier started. Bottling wine, Burgundy was a speciality, but you know, Bordeaux, Alsace, you know, everything. And after the Second World War, my father took it over and developed it further, wholesaling around the UK, pioneering a lot of, you know, new wines at the time. You know, the UK was very much a Bordeaux market, but sort of going against the grain with things like Burgundy. So, I mean, I grew up in a wine trade family, very much used to going against the grain. And that's sort of been a theme that runs through the rest of my career. So when I left school, I worked in J.B. Rainier's cellars, bottling wine. It was the end of that sort of London bottling era that really sustained the wine trade, you know, in that post-war phase. You know, mise en bouteille au château. You know, that boast that you see on bottles and stuff, you know, that was because, you know, because most of it was actually bottled in Europe. You know, it wasn't bottled at the chateau at the time. You know, I can remember seeing my father's tasting notes of Chateau Lafite, you know, barrel by barrel by barrel. You know, you put a white mark on the barrels you wanted and those came over and you then bottled them up. You know, so in those days there were many different bottlings of, you know, for example, Chateau Lafite. Or Ducru Beaucaillou, or whatever it was. And some bottlers were better at it than others. But that was the reputation that the company had, was being a very good bottler of wine. And so in 1980, that's where I started, bottling wine, in Victoria, in Pimlico. And bottling and labelling and dispatching and distributing wine, which I did for 3 or 4 years. It was a sort of fin de siècle sort of era when a lot of the family wine merchants were being squeezed by the arrival of the broking market and the Parker market that sort of took the top end away, and then being squeezed at the bottom end by the power of the supermarkets that sort of were developing. And the homogeneity of wine supplies, you know, coming from the New World, for example. So it was sort of end of an era, really. And one by one, all the family merchants, you know, got bought up and amalgamated and consolidated. And eventually, it happened to my father's company, bought by a brewery called Eldritch Pope, which in itself has been amalgamated and consolidated into Bass Charrington or whatever. But I suppose at the time I felt a bit miffed about it, but it gave me some opportunities. One was to get involved in retail. So running a retail wine shop in the city of London, Fleet Lane at Old Bailey, at the Old Bailey, with a little sort of wine bar there. And that was quite a good experience because it allowed you to access the end consumer directly. This idea of in the wine trade at the time was you had to have this encyclopedic knowledge of wine, the vineyard, the weather patterns, the vintages, the growers, the terroirs, and to make a commercial decision. And then, once you'd made that commercial decision and put your money on the line, you then had to pack it up, wrap it up, and find a market for it and communicate it. So it was quite an evolved method. And it wasn't stuff that you could look up in a book. It was acquired knowledge. And I can remember at the time thinking, you got this encyclopedic knowledge, but how do you valorize it? When you got the sort of the Parker stuff coming along with a book that sort of says, this is 93 points. Well, and I can remember, finding how disappointing it was that you had this extraordinary awareness, knowledge, but you couldn't really use it to maximum effect. And that's when I started thinking of looking around at doing something else. And of course, another part of that Eldritch Pope experience was it was my first encounter with whiskey. So this, I'm talking about around about 1983. And I was sort of sentenced to a sort of stage at Dorchester in Dorset. With this wonderful old brewery making real ale. But they also used to make their own blended whiskey. And for that blended whiskey, they needed single malts in it. And I can remember, I can smell it now. Going into this damp, dark Dorset cellar and seeing these, there were sherry butts. The long, elongated barrels, and all sort of damp and sort of crusted, lying there, and they had this policy of laying down these spirits, from zero age, so that they had a whole retinue of these barrels, and that smell, that wonderful damp spirit smell of a warehouse. And helping vat these barrels together to make the blended whiskey. And it was a very, in every sense of the word, a very heady, very engaging experience. And I can really feel it now. And that was quite an eye opener. That was my first experience of any whiskey at all. And then I ran this sort of for Eldritch Pope. I ran this shop in the city, and then one day and along came the particulars of a wine company that was for sale. And I remember looking at it, thinking, "Why don't I do that?" And so, with the help of one or two of my customers that I met in my wine shop, we raised some money to buy the wine company, which was called La Reserve in Walton Street in Knightsbridge. And so that was fine wine. So that was moving to a different part of London. That was combining really a wine shipping role, which is what I knew from my family company, with a retail business, which I'd worked out with Eldritch Pope. So it was bringing those two things together. And we specialized in Burgundy, You know, when my father used to go to Burgundy, there was Rousseau, there was de Vogüé, there was d'Angeville, and there was one of the négociants, Favelet or Drouin. And that was it. That was five visits. Now, when my father came with me on one of my trips to Burgundy around about 1983, 84, we were going to 60 visits, 60 cellars. Now, that was a change over that sort of 20-year period where you had this sort of second post-war generation coming back to the Burgundy vineyards. You know, that sort of cooperative idea post-war had been rejected, and people were coming back to make their own wine, to take back the vineyards, to market and vinify their own wines. So it was a real change of era. It was a change of pace. And it was very exciting to come across these terroirs that had been farmed out to other people, to the négociants, to be there when they were being taken back into family control. And of course, it coincided with experimentation with oak, the reawakening of what was possible with barrels. They weren't just containers, you know, the manky old barrels used again and again and again. You know, people were experimenting with new oak, with different forests, Troncay, Allier, Vosges, different toastings, you know, and I was there, witnessing the experiments with them, with these growers, you know, year in, year out. You were witnessing, you know, this worked, that didn't. Very exciting. And then the evolution round about 85, 86, 87 of the organic movement and the biodynamic movement. You know, I can remember vividly the 1990 vintage in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, Domaine de Marcoux, and coming across biodynamics for the first time and thinking, you know, basically, you know, this guy was taking the piss. You know, I was being ridiculed. But then suddenly realizing, actually, you know what? Actually, no, this is quite interesting. So that was the second. And then, of course, you had various enological advances, batonnage and things like that, and different yeasts. And so it was a very, very enlightening era to be involved in wine, and specifically Burgundy, because it is so hands-on. You know, you're dealing with a vigneron, not a guy in a suit, a vigneron, you know, with dirty hands, you know, that gets involved in the cellar. So it's very, very direct. And I loved it. And it was a deeply influential experience. So when I then... obviously, we were retailing wines, retailing spirits too. Yeah. We didn't bother with whiskey. I mean, you know, I'm how old am I? 58 now. You know, we never drank whiskey. You know, whiskey was an old man's thing, and it was whiskey Mac, whiskey soda, whiskey. You know, we never. You know, there was never. My father used to, you know, when we used to go on holidays to my mother's family in the West Coast, you know, we'd have some Lefroy or Leapfrog, as he used to call it. But that was a sort of, you know, that was as far as it got. So when I started retailing wine, if you're going to have some spirits, you know, we had a few cognacs, a few armagnacs, and you know, that was about it. And that's when I came across by accident, Bruichladdich, one of those serendipitous discoveries. I was at the London Wine Fair of 1985, and for the first time they held it in Excel, which is in Docklands, which was just becoming a thing. And it was not in its usual Olympia venue. And I can remember it because no one turned up. The place was empty. And I can remember walking down these aisles, you know, and I'd just bought La Reserve. And so I was going there to see, you know, what's out there, you know, wine wise, you know. And I can remember walking down these aisles completely empty and being accosted by this big hairy Scot who grabbed me and spanned me around. Bearded fellow who turned out to be Jack Milroy, a grand personage of the whiskey world, and he sort of said in this very gruff voice, you know, he said, do you want to win a bottle of whiskey? And I said, well, what do I have to do? And he said, well, give me your visiting card and I'll put it in a, you know, hat, and we have a lucky draw at the end of the, you know, the exhibition, and there's a bottle of whiskey that's worth £1,000. 1985. And so I didn't have a visiting card. So he gave me his own, crossed out his name, put my name on it, stuck it in the hat, and I thought nothing of it. And at the end of that week, I got this phone call, and it was Jack, and he said I'd won the prize. So I thought, wow, brilliant. So I went round to Milroy's in Soho, and you know, there was this bottle. It was a 50-year-old Balvenie. I remember that. And he gave it to me. And I thought, well, this is great. You know, I never win prizes. And he said, well, look, you know, whilst you're here, you must try some barrel samples. And of course, remember, the only whiskey I'd seen were these barrels being blended in Dorchester, Elder Pope. And so out of courtesy, I thought, you know, I've got to do it out of courtesy. I can't take this thing and you know. So I tried these barrels. Samples, those little wee bottles, and I tasted them, you know, exactly as you would a wine. Nose them, and I was horrified, absolutely horrified. You know, the assault on one's senses. You know, the peat, the reek, the iodine, Christ alive. But you know, trying to, you know, be smiling, you know, be terribly British, and then one of them, I thought, wow. One of them just blew me away because, like I'd been brought up with at Sunday lunch, family lunches, since I was a 7 or 8, every Sunday lunch we had as a family, the discipline was that before we could eat, we had to identify what the wine was in the decanter on the table. Now, I don't mean, you know, it was a question of a process of question and answer. But, you know, that was the discipline that we had, which made you think about what you were tasting. That was the point. And by a process of elimination, you could work out what the thing was in the decanter. So fantastic, fantastic education. You know, and so using that same, you know, that triangle of, you know, acidity, tannin, fruit, you know, that balance, you know, looking for balance, which is what wine tasting is all about, is looking for harmony. I did the same thing, and this knows this whiskey, and thought, wow, you know, this is actually, the others didn't, but this is responding to that treatment. And, you know, here was a harmonious spirit that I just didn't think you could get. You know, it had this perfect balance between the different elements, and it was such a shock to me. It was so incredible. I remember it was the beginning of when they had the national lottery had just started, and the advertising on TV was about this big sort of. The big finger, you know, the big finger, like straight out of Monty Python, you know, the clouds part and this big finger, godlike finger. It could be you. It could be you. And that was what I thought. It could be me. I've discovered something that nobody knows exists. I'm at the front of the queue. I've stumbled completely by accident on something that nobody knows anything about. And I can remember leaving Milroy's, thinking, well, it's over to you, man. You've got to do something about this. You are in pole position. So, you know, with a view to starting my wine company, if I was going to sell a whiskey, it's got to be this one. It's got to be this Brookladdy thing. And I tracked it down, and it was, you know, with difficulty, because remember, this is before single malt whiskey really took off. And everybody thinks that single malt whiskey has been around for years and years and years and years and years. Well, of course it has, but not marketed. It was blended whiskey that people drank. It was blended whiskey that the industry wanted you to have. The unlimited volumes, the marketable volumes of blended whiskey, not the esoteric component single malt whiskies. No, they wanted to keep those under the table. They didn't want you to have those. So they were deliberately suppressed, apart from two, you know, Macallan and Glenfiddich, that had been marketed as single malts in their own right. But apart from that, you know, 0.01% of whiskey value at that time was single malt whiskey. It was non-existent. And, you know, here was a chance to find this spirit. And I remember selling it on the basis that if you are a wine drinker, this is the whiskey for you. That it was as simple as that. And so we did that for 2, 3, 4 years to round about, I think it was 1989, when I thought, well, I've got to go and see this place, Brookladdy. So I set off with my brother. It's the only holiday we've ever been on together, where we basically played all the island golf courses on the west coast of Scotland by bicycle. And we started at Troon, and we went to Campbelltown, and we went to Springbank. It was the first distillery I'd visited. Then over to Isla and round Isla, and turned up at Brookladdy. And I sort of was expecting, like with the wine trade, you know, you expect, you know, as a customer, you know, you expect, you know, to be welcomed and, you know, thank you very much, and, you know, for your support, and come on in and have a look around. And but of course, it was the opposite. There was nobody there, and it was all falling apart, and it was rusted, corroded, weeds growing out of the gutters. It had been shut down, and there was a big sign on the door. It had just four words, and those words were, "Plant closed, no visitors!" Exclamation mark. I'll never forget it. Four really, you know, plant, not distillery or, you know, plant, you know, factory like word. Plant closed, no visitors. Fuck off. And I was, you know, I was just shocked, because it was just not what I was expecting. And I'd come all this way by bicycle to see this extraordinary place. And I was absolutely crestfallen, completely and utterly broken. It's just not what I was expecting. And I remember seeing somebody cross the courtyard, and I rattled the gates. And this guy came over, and he was pretty pissed off. And he said, "Well, what the hell do you want?" You know. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm your best customer. You know? I've come all this way by bicycle. Can I, you know, can you let me in? Can I at least come in and have a look around? You know, can I take some photographs?" And he went, "No, you can fuck off." And that was my introduction. And I thought, bloody hell. And so that was like red rag. I thought, well, bugger this. So as I sort of left, I thought, that's it. I'm not having anything to do with this. I'm not having anything to do with this at all. This is shit. This is just not what I was expecting. And I got back to London, and I thought, that's it. I just got rid of every last bottle, and I thought, I'm just not having anything to do with this. And that winter, so this must have been, you know, sort of the end of the summer when this all happened. So that Christmas, that January, you know, I can share that January feeling in the wine trade where, you know, your whole year builds to that Christmas crescendo, and you work like mad right up to Christmas Eve. Last minute people buying bottles, you know, it was the best moment. You know, people would throw caution to the wind. They'd buy anything. You know, it was an amazing, exciting period. And then it would all wind down on Christmas Eve, you know, when it was all sort of, you know, finished, and you'd pack your stuff up and you'd do that journey home, you know, the Christmas Eve journey home. I can remember doing this, you know, all those years. And then you'd come back after Christmas. Of course, no one wants to drink any wine after Christmas. You know, it's so depressing. You know, everybody's got complete sort of liver failure. And the last thing people want to talk about is wine, or and it's that juxtaposition of, you know, that excitement, that crescendo to that sort of awful emptiness of January and stock taking and all that sort of stuff. But I thought about this Brookladdy distillery thing. And I thought, well, if it's closed, I'll write to the owners and I'll ask them to sell it to me. They won't, of course, but at least, you know, I'll have got it off my chest, and I'd have brought that sort of little conundrum, closed the circle of this extraordinary spirit and this appalling, you know, place. And so I did. So I wrote to these guys, and true enough, they wrote back saying, thank you very, very much. But, you know, get lost sort of thing, in a very nice way. But I'd got it off my chest. And that was okay. Well, it was okay until next January, where the same thing happened, where you sit there and you think, oh, Christ, what am I going to do now? I wrote again. And I wrote again every January for the next 10 years. And my letters got increasingly more aggressive. And of course, in between time, I'd started my own little whiskey company called Murray McDavid, named after my grandparents, my mother's side, bottling up other people's whiskies naturally, doing it in a wine trade way. You know, putting together three or four interesting barrels to make something even more compelling, bottling it naturally without colouring it or chill filtering it, you know, extolling the individuality of it all. And that was really good fun, because that was a period where a lot of these barrels were being offloaded. It was a period of rationalisation. You know, the 82, 83, 84 oil crisis had resulted in a lot of overstocking of barrels of whiskey from the big companies, and so they sold them off. And the things they sold off first were the whiskies that they'd shut down the last crisis of 73-74. So these were barrels of whiskey that were distilled in the 60s from distilleries that didn't exist anymore. And they were being sold off for peanuts. So it was an absolutely halcyon period of being able to acquire these wonderful barrels, the age of innocence, before it all got really industrial, and bottling them up. And so it was a pioneering period of single malt. This was the catalyst for the single malt whiskey market we enjoy today was that oil crisis of the early 80s. That was the catalyst, where the big guys offloaded stocks from things that they'd shut down, you know, a decade earlier. That was the single catalyst. The cat was let out of the bag by accident, and various independent bottlers or parasites, the whiskey industry would call you, liberated these stocks and offered them naturally into the marketplace. And so, you know, the original sort of pathfinder people had an absolutely amazing, you know, this is spirit. I remember the time thinking, this is spirit that we make in our own country. You know, you're not going to France to buy it. You know, this is something we make ourselves. It's our national, it ought to be our national drink, you know. Remember, you know, blended whiskey in the UK had collapsed. You know, since the 70s, the volumes of blended whiskey had halved. All right? You know, it was a collapsing market. There was no single malt whiskey. It had collapsed. So this was, you know, to the industry was like a breath of fresh air. They couldn't believe their luck that, you know, these barrels wasting away in Scotland. Suddenly people were prepared to pay money for them. And of course the return on those was far greater than a container of, bog standard blended whiskey. And so the marketing guys, these distillery companies latched onto it, for, making their, end of year budgets, selling, 10 cases of this was worth, a thousand of, a blended. And so it all took off. The conditions were there and it took off, like Billio. And I was there at that time. So it was a very, very exciting moment. And then eventually in January 2000, my plea, by now more of a rant, was answered. They said, yeah, okay, well, we will sell it to you. By now, of course, Invergordon had been bought by White Mackay. White Mackay had been bought by Jim Beam. And so really I was dealing with the Americans, Jim Beam. And I just said, look, this is, you've got to use it or lose it. Do something with it. And they said, right, well, if you can prove to us that you can raise the money, then we'll let you buy it. Wow, shit, Christ. suddenly I had to do something. And so that's where my distillery experience started. And it was a crazy year of, getting together sort of, private equity at the time, was quite, again, through my wine company contacts, they'd seen where I was going. They'd seen what I was doing with Murray McDavid. And so they helped me, get together that core of private equity. The problem was, as always, was getting bank finance. Nobody, who the hell are you? Whiskey distilleries are bought by whiskey conglomerates, not by private wine trading people. And so there was this huge credibility problem. And, we almost lost the deal, actually, because of it. And it was only in December, at the end of the year, where basically the bank that we went to, we'd approached 30 banks. And we'd been sent packing by all of them. But it was eventually the Bank of Scotland said, well, basically we've got no other deals to do. We'll get to yours. And so it all ended up with a sort of, it's got to be done by Christmas or it's off. And so it ended up being a bit of a panic, to put it mildly. That's another story. December the 19th, the same day my son Rory was born, we took possession of Brooklandy Distillery. And that's where that my distilling career started. The acquisition of the distillery nearly didn't happen. Very, very nearly didn't happen. The delay in securing, the bank finance almost compromised the whole thing. And in fact, if it wasn't, this is very Scottish, in fact, because if it wasn't for my solicitor meeting the CEO of Jim Beam Scotland over the vegetable counter in Waitrose on a Sunday morning, it's one of those things, the guy said, look, is this guy up for it? Is this guy real? And my solicitor was able to say, yep, he's got the backing, but it's, and that's when they said, look, if it's not done by Friday, December the 19th, it's all off. And so it all ended up going to the wire, literally to the wire, where, all my shareholders that we'd got together had to send their money. and, you know, some of it hadn't arrived, and you know, the bank account had to have this, I think it was at the time, I think it was something like 4 million quid in it. It had to be there at midday to be transferred. And if it wasn't, the deal was off. And we were still a million short. It hadn't turned up. Electronically sent, but it hadn't arrived, you know. And I can remember sitting in this office of this solicitor, and he was saying, well, what are you going to do? Because this money needs to be there in 3 hours' time. And if it isn't, we're going to have to call them up and tell them that you've blown it. And the humiliation, like I can remember it now, you know, the feeling of humiliation. I'd been badgering these people. I'd been telling them, you know, that when, you know, and here at the last final hurdle, you know, the stuff that I'd sorted out at the beginning of the year, you know, as the easiest bit, getting the private equity, had turned out to be the Achilles heel and was now going to cost me this whole bloody thing. And I didn't know what to do. It was, you know, a rabbit in headlights thing. You know, what else could I do? I, every favour had been called, everything. And, you know, the hours ticked by and eventually got to 11 o'clock. And I was just melting, just absolutely, you know, completely melting. Just the humiliation. That's what I remember, was the humiliation, just thinking how, you know, I've let everybody down. I've let, it was just awful. I'm not even thinking that actually, you know, this would probably be bankruptcy, and I didn't even think about that. It was just how I'd let everybody down that had supported me up to that point. And he said, well, you better start thinking what you're going to say, because we're going to have to call up the MD and tell him that you've failed. And they went away, left me there stewing. And then at 5 minutes to 12, they all trooped in, all the solicitors that had been working on this, you know, the conveyancing, the, you know, all that. And they all stood around me, and I sat there, you know, it was like a firing squad, you know. And they said, well, you know, we're now going to make the call. And there was a telephone on the middle of the table. And, you know, And so he went to press the button. And he said, look, just before we do that, we'll call the cash desk just, you know, one last time. And they called the cash desk, and the girl at the other end said, here we are. And he said, has that money for Mark, has that come in yet? And she said, oh, I'm really sorry, but no, nothing's come in. We were expecting there to be 4 million. There isn't. It's 3 million something or other. I'm sorry to say. So he was just leaning across to press the button to end the call, and she said, wait, something's coming in. And you could hear a machine, sort of like a teleprinter, going chick 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 chick. And she said, no, something's coming in. And she got out a calculator, and you could hear her tapping these numbers. And you know, she said, yeah, it's 3 million. No, sorry, I got it wrong. The total is 4 million. And I just leapt in the air, and I just danced around this table. It was the most extraordinary moment of my life. And I just jumped up and down, and I jigged and jigged and jigged and jigged. And they said, calm down. You know, oh, fuck you. So when I say it went to the wire, I really mean it went to the wire. It was so close. And I can't, you know, and there's no exaggeration in that. That's exactly what happened. Anyhow, so that started the roller coaster journey with Brookladdie, and it never really sort of calmed down from that moment onwards. So the first thing we did was obviously take down that wretched sign, which was great, most enjoyable to do. And it was getting back all the boys that used to work there, you know, and that knew how this old Victorian machinery worked, renovating it, getting it. So we spent a year, reworking all that wonderful machinery. And you know, grinding it down, you know, polishing it up, painting it. You know, the simplicity was marvelous. This wonderful simplicity of the Victorian era. You know, really simple, big cogs, and it was just fantastic. Not a microchip in the place. And we started distilling in May. May the 31st, I think it was, in 2001. And that was a very emotional moment. And of course, what do we do? I mean, well, how do you run a distillery? Well, of course, you know, what I know is wine led. So, you know, remember, you know, the wood, my experience of wood. So that, you know, let's get that involved. Let's actually think about the wood, because up till then, wood in whiskey didn't feature. It was a container. The barrels since the early 70s were just used again and again and again and again. You know, they just painted over the end, you know, stamped it, and off it went again. These barrels were inert. This was the biggest problem the industry had, in my view, was that they were just using these. You know, if plastic had been possible, they would have used plastic. You could, with your thumb, you could peel off the paint off the end of the barrels, and you could see the different colours that had been painted, you know, one over the other, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. And of course, each time you put a spirit in that barrel, it extracts the flavour from the wood, until there's nothing left in the wood. So the wood is contributing zippo. You put in, you know, clear spirit, and 20, 30 years later, clear spirit comes out because the wood is inert. It was, but of course, why did they do that? Because of economics. It was much cheaper to do. One of the terrible, in my view, terrible inventions of the early 70s, and it coincided with the opposite, which was E-150 caramel, which allowed a bottler, brand owner, to colour the whiskey at bottling time. So, you know, in other words, it was you know, instead of spending money on barrels, you know, you just bought a few drums of caramel, and that was the trade off. You know, okay, caramel is allowed; it's a legal additive, it's a legal permitted if it is used to standardize the color, to get a homogeneous color, which you can sort of understand for a big brands. But if it's used to sweeten the whiskey, it's illegal. And this is one of the great sort of, you know, Scotch Whiskey Association paradoxes is you can add E-150 if it's for colouring, but not for sweetening. And it's caramel, you know. So obviously we weren't going to colour the stuff. We weren't going to chill filter it. We were going to bottle naturally. My experiences of doing this with Murray McDavid. And that's what we did. So that meant a proactive wood policy, which meant money. And, you know, it's one of the first things I learned about whiskey making is there is no real shortcut to a proactive wood policy. Mm-hmm. And that's where my wine experiences came into play. We introduced French oak, which really wasn't, you know, much thought of. In fact, we were pilloried for using French oak, but all the great talking heads, you know, all the, you know, the great sort of whiskey master distillers, you know, which is basically a PR man. They all slagged us off. You know, how dare you? You know, what are you doing using French oak? You know, that's the, you know, the devil's work. You know, no. You know, says the guy, you know, using, you know, completely inert, overused American oak. But of course, you know, I knew from my wine days in London, bottling wine. What did I do with the barrels once we'd emptied them and bottled the wine? in Victoria. What did we do with those barrels? We sent them to Scotland. I did it myself, sending them to distillers, which, of course, is what happened during, you know, all that, you know, previous century. Every barrel of every spirit or wine that came into this country, the barrels went off to Scotland, whether they were port, sherry, you know, wine, red wine, white wine, they all went to Scotland. So, you know, this idea that French oak wasn't used is a complete nonsense. It was just the industry didn't like the idea that we were doing it proactively. And that was very much the nature of the game for the first 10 years of Bruichladdich, was that, you know, everything we did got questioned and pilloried and laughed at by, you know, an industry that was so homogenous and so disconnected, you know, distilling from marketing. Over here on the left, you do all the distilling, cheapest liter of alcohol possible. And on the right, you spend all the money spinning a yarn, telling a story, pulling wool over people's eyes. That was the 20th century marketing model that allowed these big drinks companies to get so very, very, very big. It was a disconnect between the two. And then we had the temerity to turn up and say, well, actually, you know what? It's actually a lot more interesting than that. So I put all the onus on distillation, not the marketing side of it, the distillation side of it. That's what was interesting to me. That was like getting back into the vineyards again. That was like, you know, understanding the wood and what it would do, and how about this, how about that, what if, you know. And yes, I suppose a frustrated vigneron. I had owned a vineyard. My family had owned a small part of a Grand Cru vineyard in Burgundy. I was aware of you know for a long time, you know, the winemaking principles. But you know, here was my chance to actually sort of do it myself, I suppose, you know. With spirits. So yes, unashamedly, having spent 20 years in the wine trade, wine shipping, retailing, wholesaling, literally from 1980 through to 2000, I have spent the next 20 years in the whiskey industry. So you know, half and half. Which I think gives me an unusual perspective in this trade, that I've seen it from all sides. You know, I've seen it from that wine side, and now I've seen it from the distilling side, which I think gives you a much better perspective of the... And, of course, that really pissed off the whiskey people. And, you know, coming from the wine world where you know, we all know the details about each and every wine and who grows it and how they grow it, the terroir, you know, that knowledge that I was telling about, you know, that knowledge that we take for granted in the wine trade, the whiskey, there wasn't any. You know, what's there to know? There's 110 distilleries. I mean, there's, you know, 8,000 wineries in Burgundy alone. It's you know, the scale of but of course, where's the money? It's in the whiskey, not the wine world. And I can remember, you know, actively thinking that my father would turn in his grave, going from the light side to the dark side. That here I was actively going from what I knew, the wine world, into the darkness of the spirit world. And I can remember that deliberate feeling coming over me that I was going to the dark side. Here was an industry where 60% of production was controlled by just five companies. And here was, you know, I was going into this den. Everything that we in the wine world despised, you know, the consolidation, the money, the marketing, all the things that we don't have or didn't have in the wine world. And there it was in the spirit world. Really very, very clever people with huge amounts of marketing money selling something that was, you know, these huge brands, you know, brands, you know, we didn't really know about in the wine world. You know, Le Musigny from De Vogue or, you know, Meunier. I mean, is that a brand? I mean, we didn't think there were brands. You know, it's a terroir. So it was a very, you know, disconcerting move, but a deliberate one. And, you know, I was determined to bring a wine world view to this industrial sector. And nothing was going to stop me doing it. So that's what we started. And it ruffled a lot of feathers. Even with my own, you know, within my own company, you know, that's not how whiskey distilleries are run. You know, we'll be laughed at. You know, we'll be this. You know, there was a huge negativity. And from outside, you know, within the industry itself and with the, you know, the Scotch Whiskey Association, you can't do that. You can't do this. You can't do that. Well, why not? And that was very much our watchword. Why not? Who says? If it makes better whiskey, you know, if we use French oak, if we use higher toasted oak, or we use oak from the high mountains of the Vosges or the low forests of the Limousin, you know, why not? It's interesting. Now, what I bought with Bruichladdy was a bunch of old buildings and Victorian machinery from 1881. But primarily what we bought was 1 million litres of maturing spirit back to 1964. And I suppose what, you know, the question you asked me earlier was, you know, how would you run this distillery? I mean, you know, the industry, what would they have done? And what they would have done is they would have taken that 1 million litres and they would have blended them all together and created one standard homogenized version of Bruichladdy. And they would have marketed the hell out of it. And that's what they would have done. And then they would have probably shut down the distillery or left it shut down and just asset stripped the stock. That's what the industry probably would have done. Well, I wanted to distill the whiskey. I wanted to make whiskey and to put into practice my wine points, my wine trade background. So Bruichladdy for me as a project was very much a two-part project. One part was adding value to this whiskey that we'd bought on December the 19th at full market value. And distilling new whiskey the way I wanted to do it. So it was a two-part project. So the first part was you know, creating a brand around whiskey that we didn't distill. Somebody else had distilled with none of the values that you know, turned me on. And so therefore we had to be pretty light on our feet and pretty quick about it. Creating a distribution network around the world. People that couldn't even pronounce this name, you know, Bruichladdy, a brand that no one had ever heard of, and with stocks that were very expensive. So, you know, it was a pretty difficult job. We had to go back to our shareholders a couple of times to get more money when we ran out. And then you realize just how small you are. You know, when it goes to bottling, you know, everybody else gets priority, not you. You know, we missed our first Christmas market because we missed our window for bottling. We were bumped, if I remember rightly, by Chivas Regal. And so, you know, you miss out a whole prime selling period. That was our first winter, our first, you know, we missed it entirely. So it was very difficult. So then it was a question of, you know, on the production end, the distillation end, was to try and persuade farmers to grow barley. You know, whiskey is, that's what it's about. It's about barley. That's what makes it the most complex spirit in the world, is that extraordinary grain. And, you know, here we are on this Hebridean island, Isla. You know, no one's growing barley. Why not? They used to, 100 years earlier. It was, you know, after the First World War, when basically a lot of young lads never came back. That's when they stopped growing barley. At the time, you know, it had supported, you know, 20 small farm scale distilleries. Now, those had all evolved and developed. You know, Brookladdy, Boonehaven were both built as deliberately as distilleries. So by then, there was, I think, 8 distilleries, much bigger distilleries. But, you know, barley was being imported from wherever, Timbuktu. So the thing I felt about, you know, distilling was, you know, we needed a bit of authenticity here. I mean, we needed a bit of honesty, which is what we get in the wine world. None of the smoke and mirrors and deceit and deception of the spirits industry. So, you know, if it says it's made, it's called Scotch whiskey, well, then surely, to goodness, it should be made with Scottish barley. And that was the first thing, was to secure supplies of only Scottish barley. And then, you know, Isla whiskey, well, it ought to be Isla barley. But, you know, so we started, you know, Richard McCare was the first farmer we were able to persuade to grow barley for us on Isla. And it's not easy. It's a very short growing season. A lot of extraordinary daylight because of, you know, how far west you are. But you can't get on the ground until, you know, May. And then you've got basically 100 days before, you know, you can ripen because of this extra daylight that we get. Before the geese turn up and eat it all, or the autumn gales. So it's a very difficult place to grow barley properly. But bit by bit we did. We ended up with, I think it was 10 farms growing barley for us on Isla. And then the rest coming from the East Coast. We started using organic barley, even biodynamic barley. And it was very, very good fun. So there came a transition phase round about 2007, 2008, 2009, where we started moving away from the spirit that we had inherited to using the spirit that we had distilled ourselves. And that was a big moment. That was a very exciting moment. You know, we did this. This is us. And people started to pay attention to what we were doing and stopped ridiculing us and stopped sort of pointing fingers and belittling, and started to realize that actually, you know, yes, there was something in this. And true to form, you know, it was such a marketing-led industry. You know, when they see an advantage, they copy. So, you know, the wood started to become more predominant. Everybody started talking about wood. You started getting, you know, French wood on whiskey labels. You know, the very people that had been slagging me off for using French oak were now extolling the virtues of, you know, that hypocrisy was astounding. And of course, it became flavor of the month. You know, this is what whiskey's all about, the wood. It's all about the wood. 60% of a whiskey's flavor comes from the wood. No, 70%. No, 80% of a whiskey's flavor comes from the wood. Complete bollocks. But I mean, you know, the simplisticness of that marketing muscle, because everything has to be dumbed down to the lowest possible common denominator. You know, it just ends up with that awful, you know, people using these terms without really understanding them, just because it sounds good. So by the time we get onto barley, talking about barley, you know, I can tell you right now, they'll all be talking about barley. All these companies will be talking about barley in the next 4 or 5 years. They'll all be doing it. Having gone from, oh, it doesn't matter, barley's irrelevant, it doesn't matter where it comes from, just the same story as the wood, They'll all be telling you, oh, terroir this, terroir that, you know. You can guarantee it. And terroir, my friends, is a word that is going to be so badly corrupted by these very clever marketing guys because it's so ephemeral. What the hell does it mean? There is no English translation of it. You know, it's a pompous French term, which I mean, what the hell does it mean? So it is going to be corrupted like you've never seen it. And I'm sorry to say I've started it by using the terroir, explaining terroir, but I know it will be traduced because that's what this industry does. They don't understand it. They don't want to understand it. They just use and squeeze every last marketing piece out of it, and then they drop it and walk away. So at the moment, that's wood. It's been squeezed to death. And then the next thing will be barley. So I'm sorry to say, you can blame me for it.
Thank you so much, Mark. It was an absolute pleasure to hear your story. As you can no doubt tell, this episode takes us up to the start of the journey with Waterford, which will conclude in the next episode, number 374. If you haven't already, do please subscribe to the podcast so that you're alerted when new episodes go live. To do so, just head to interpretingwine.com/listen. And as ever, I would love to have you following along with me on social media, where I'm at Interpreting Wine on Instagram and Facebook, at Wine Podcast on Twitter, and email hello@interpretingwine.com. See you next time.